From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Historian Juan Cole says religion isn't the primary cause of conflict in the Middle East.
The big conflicts in Egypt in the past 20 years, a lot of them have had to do with labor.
On today's show, we'll continue with the second half of my conversation with Juan Cole about the modern Middle East. But first, Charlie Kenny and I will discuss the current political and economic crisis in Venezuela.
What we're observing is the consequences of a populist leader who has lost popularity.
That's all coming up after news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. Charlie Kenny, let's talk about Venezuela. They've been in the headlines. This country has been going through a very difficult time for several months. Violent protests really since April. About 100 people have died. But this is a big week in Venezuela, given that Maduro has called for elections that will be held on Sunday, actually, so we won't know the results of those. But lots of outcry about even having these elections, concerns about the president grabbing too much power, trying to hold on to power. Lots of trouble in Venezuela. Can you kind of set this up for us a little bit, tell us a little bit about what's happening, and especially the implications of what we might see happening this week?
What we're observing is the consequences of a populist leader who has lost popularity and who is trying to remain in power by using whatever instruments that is under his control. He has the constitutional authority to call for a national constitutional convention, and he has done so with the purpose of replacing a legislature where the opposition has around two-thirds of a majority against him. And so he has, until now, earlier than this, used the Supreme Court to obstruct the legislature and all of its actions against him. And now he's seeking to replace all of those institutions with new institutions that would be firmly and completely under his control.
Now, I want to follow up on what you said. A populist leader that has lost popularity. Why is that? He was quite popular when he took office after Chavez. So what's happened for him to lose his popularity?
Well, a populist leader, it's a category of leadership in which you have someone who seeks to polarize the electorate into those in favor of, quote unquote, the people against some kind of elite. And this can be a very successful strategy in mobilizing the population, but it does not necessarily mean that that leader is going to have the support of a majority of the citizens. So we have populist leaders who do have majoritarian support, and we have populist leaders who do not. In this case, Nicolas Maduro barely won the 2013 elections, so he did not have massive popular support at that time. And many thought that the elections were not free and fair and that he, in fact, had lost those elections. So he had something close to a plurality, but not an overwhelming number of people behind him at that point. And since then, pretty much everything that could go bad for Venezuela has gone bad, both for external reasons and for the errors of the government. And so his popularity has steadily declined. About 85% of the people in Venezuela think that this election should not happen. He has an approval rating in the low 20s, which is not the lowest in Latin America. So there's still a nucleus of people, 19-20%, who are in favor of what he's doing.
So these elections that will be held on Sunday, as you mentioned, there's a lot of opposition to that. Even the Trump administration has said that they should not be holding these elections. So the opposition has called for protests, daily protests. There have been largely daily protests in Venezuela, particularly in the capital, since early April. I assume we're likely to see that continue until and whether these will take place. But do you expect that the elections will take place on Sunday as he has planned? I mean, he still has the military behind him, right?
He does. And as strong and as extensive as the protests have been, it is difficult to force someone out of power if they have the consolidated support of the military, which until now he has had. So I think the elections will go forth. The strategy of the opposition is to boycott them, to not recognize their legitimacy. And so those who do vote on Sunday will most certainly vote almost overwhelmingly in favor of this measure.
And this is probably what he's counting on, right, is that the opposition will stay away and that he will win these elections. So then what will the outcome be once these elections take place? He'll have a majority now in the in this assembly? I mean, what exactly are the implications of a win for him?
The implications, at least from his point of view, is that he will have an assembly that is in support of him. That assembly will displace, cancel, if you will, the National Legislative Assembly. It will no longer exist. They could do the same with the Supreme Court if they wish. They can cancel and postpone the 2018 elections, which he was supposed to run again in 2018 and most certainly lose. So they could postpone that. So it is a path toward remaining in power that institutionally could work. It's just hard to see how a country in which 80% of the population is against everything you're doing, how that is going to work. But institutionally, it could.
So obviously, this is a threat to democracy in the country. I mean, would you consider this country a democracy at this point in time, the way it's operating? You said he had constitutional authority to do this, but does that mean that this is a democratic move on his part?
No. I mean, the country has not been a democracy since about the mid to late 2000s, before the death of Chavez, and this due to other manipulations of electoral processes, but most importantly, freedom of the press being infringed upon and such, and judicial attacks on opposition that were rather systematic and documented by every international observer possible. So this is something that is not recognized legitimate by almost any international body or country. It's not just the United States that oppose it, but Brazil and Argentina and Peru and other countries. He does have some support.
All right, Charlie. Well, thank you so much for this update. And we'll obviously be back in touch soon to see what happens after the elections. Thank you.
We will. Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org or like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter. We're at WorldviewsKGOU and I'm at Suzette Grolot. Next, we'll continue my two-part interview with historian Juan Cole about the factors that shape the modern Middle East. I'm Suzette Grolot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grolot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Juan Cole is a professor of history at the University of Michigan and an expert on the Middle East. His most recent book is The New Arabs: How the Wired and Global Youth of the Middle East is Transforming It. He also contributes his thoughts on the history and religion of the Middle East on his blog, Informed Comment. Last week, we spoke about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the Middle East's rapid population growth, and how poverty relates to the region's violence.
Well, you know, there certainly is sectarian violence in the region, and sectarian identity is mobilized for political purposes on some occasions. I have to tell you, Suzette, I think a lot of it is in our heads. It's the way we have decided to put the Middle East under the sign of religion, and you could understand why that might be to some extent. Although I think we go wild with it. The big conflicts in Egypt in the past 20 years, a lot of them have had to do with labor. There's an enormous textile industry in Egypt. It's about 400,000 workers. And if you've got a population of 85 million, 400,000 workers is a lot of the able-bodied workers, largely men. And they have done wildcat strikes. They've done various kinds of strikes. It's been a big saga, and there are some people who have studied this dimension of Egyptian society. I guarantee you, you could go to LexisNexis as a database for broadcast news and look Egypt and strike, and you would find no items coming from American corporate media about this subject. So this is a big thing for Egypt and for modern Egyptian society and history, but we pay no attention to it whatsoever. We don't know, you know, how many factories are there in Egypt? What's the structure of the economy? What are the problems with the Egyptian textile exports? But people are living and breathing this stuff. But if 200 people demonstrated in downtown Cairo tomorrow and were raising banners about Islam, that would be headline news on CNN.
So this issue of it all being in our heads, we're obsessed, is basically what you're suggesting. We're obsessed first with the Middle East, perhaps, in the sense that that is what makes the news. There are a number of other issues that are happening in Africa and elsewhere that don't make the news. So there's a bit of an obsession on our part with the Middle East. And then we tend to focus and perhaps incorrectly on certain aspects of their society and not others. Do you have an explanation for this? Is there a way in which we can understand why we do this? Is it just flat out misperception?
Well, the first thing I was to say is just to underline the point. Roughly in the past, since 2006 until now, as far as I can tell, the annual death toll in the war on drugs in Mexico was very similar to the annual death toll from the conflict in Iraq. Iraq, really, really big news. Mexico, until a certain proposal was made about a wall, we never heard about it. I mean, it's not that the major newspapers like New York Times or whatever didn't report the war on drugs in Mexico, but it wasn't, you know, in mass media a big thing. But the level of violence was similar to that of Iraq. So where we put our attention in foreign affairs is selective. I'll tell you, I have this kind of theory. I suppose it could be tested that the American public is not interested in friendly countries with regard to foreign affairs. They kind of write them off, not a threat, don't have to worry about it. It's kind of the old frontier attitude. You don't need to worry about the tribes that you've made the treaties with already, and you have peace with them. So you're looking on the horizon for a peer challenger or any kind of a challenger. And so who are they interested in? Iran, China, Russia now. Countries that seem not to go along with the American consensus about how the world should be run. So Mexico's a friend. It's too bad they have those problems, but that's not interesting because it's not a security threat to the average American as they conceive it. So I think in the Cold War, you know, you couldn't have a war with the Soviet Union because of mutual assured destruction. And conflicts got displaced then into the global south, into countries where you could have a conflict, and there were proxy conflicts. So that's what Vietnam was. And one of the places that was in contention and wasn't all locked up, because also like Poland was not an issue that was a Soviet sphere of influence, and it wasn't seriously challenged by the Americans. In great power politics, once a power has established a strong claim to a sphere of influence, that tends to be ceded, or of course it turns into a war if it's not. But the Middle East was not promised to anybody. It's like, if you think about it, it's like a bridal shower where all the next brides are coming from. That was the Middle East. Egypt flipped, kind of tilted towards the Soviet Union in the 60s, and then it tilted hard towards the United States in the 70s. Yemen was split. It had a communist Yemen and a nationalist Yemen. There were all these places that you could play that chess game of trying to get those people on your side and make them assets in the struggle with the Soviet Union. And I think in a way, with the rise of terrorism from the 90s, that game has gone on being played. the terms are different. The Soviet Union is gone. But I mean, it's really quite remarkable that now what's going on in Syria, what is that? That's a conflict over American and Russian spheres of influence. So that wouldn't have looked strange in the 50s. So I think that's part of it.
You're listening to my conversation with Middle East expert Juan Cole. After the break, we'll discuss how oil influences the actions of outside powers in the Middle East. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Our guest today is Juan Cole. He is a historian at the University of Michigan, and he writes on the blog Informed Comment. Before the break, we were discussing how the United States and Russia grapple for influence in the Middle East. So those who might say, but isn't it about resources or oil? This is not really the primary explanation here?
It is in some cases, it is in others. Obviously, when you have a geopolitical contest, when the United States is trying to enlist countries as assets in its power in the world, its resources are very important. So, you know, Saudi Arabia is an absolute monarchy. The people there have virtually no civil rights. Bloggers are whipped for writing criticism of the government. There are municipal elections, which are not very extensive in their fairness, and then there's no parliament. The king's word is law. When have we ever heard the State Department come out and denounce Saudi human rights record? We hear about horrible dictators who do things to their own people, don't let them have freedom. And so we never hear this about Saudi. Why is it? Because roughly 10% of the world's petroleum is being pumped in Saudi Arabia every day. And if you're a superpower, that it's really important that that oil be pumped and go out to allies like France and Japan and so forth. So sure, petroleum is and natural gas are very important in all this. But it's per case, you know, what resources a country brings to the table as a potential asset in this contest depends on the country. So Syria, for instance, doesn't have many hydrocarbons. They were pumping about 400,000 barrels a day before the civil war broke out in world terms, because the world does nearly 100 million barrels a day now. That's nothing. And, one fracked field like Bakken in North Dakota would do that. You won't have a war over that. That's ridiculous. And then some people say, well, they wanted to put a gas pipeline through it. But actually, nowadays, you can compress the gas and put it in tubes and ship it. It's called liquefied natural gas. You don't need to make a war over a pipeline route. That's ridiculous. So Syria is not about that. Syria is about other things. It's neighbors Turkey, it neighbors Israel, and the reason the Russians are really interested in it, one of the primary reasons, is it became a haven for Chechen rebels from the Caucasus, and the Russians are damned if Chechen allies are going to sweep into Damascus. And for Russia, Syria is kind of like Mexico to the United States. So Vladimir Putin looks upon it the same way that Woodrow Wilson looked upon Mexico, and that there are serious security issues here. So it's not about oil with regard to Syria.
To conclude, Juan, thank you so much for this amazing and so informative review of what we see in the Middle East. But I think the one thing that frustrates many of us is that it's hard to see any bright spots. It's hard to see any hope in the region. Where's the hope in Syria? Where's the hope in Iraq and elsewhere in the region, Egypt? I mean, so, as an expert studying the region, what would you point us to? Do you have hope in the region? Are there any bright spots, things we can look to make us feel that they will eventually see light at the end of the tunnel? Or what is it going to take for us to see light at the end of the tunnel here?
Yeah, well, regions of the world, it's hard to problematize it exactly, but regions of the world in modern history have gone through periods of great turmoil and then settled down. I think, you know, if you were living in Europe from 1870 to 1945, what bad thing didn't happen to you? There was the Franco-Prussian War and the Paris Commune and communist revolutions and two world wars. And I figure they polished off about 100 million people. So there was no end of trouble in Europe in those periods. And then after 45, they settled down for various reasons. So I think that there's this period of turmoil we're going through in the Middle East has some structural underpinnings, and that those could change. The thing that I would say is, if you look at big data, the world's getting better. The United Nations in 1990 started trying to cut down on absolute poverty, food insecurity, and those kinds of things. They've gotten it down from 1.5 billion to about 900 million. That's a huge thing in world history to have so few people, still too many, in absolute poverty. And this is true in the Middle East as well as in Africa and elsewhere. The number of wars and the number of people killed in wars in the 1960s was much larger than it is today. Maybe we are a little bit pessimistic and looking only on the dark side. And there are countries in the Middle East like Morocco, which are very poor, but have a good education system and big ambitions. Morocco is going green. They've put in 2 gigawatts of solar, 2 gigawatts of wind. They're putting in new hydro, and they're hoping in just a couple decades to run their whole economy on green energy. They're one of the more advanced societies in the world in this regard. That's happening in Morocco, in the Middle East. So there are some good news stories out there.
All right. Thank you so much, Juan, for being here today and sharing all of your insight with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Juan Cole. He is a history professor at the University of Michigan and the author of the book, The New Arabs: How the Wired and Global Youth of the Middle East is Transforming It. Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Jacob McClellan edited this interview, and Sam Dupre produced this show. For Charlie Kenny, I'm Suzette Grelot.